You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined, as always, by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton in Zoom conference. And Tim, I am speaking to you. I am out of town right now. Out of New York, I'm speaking to you from what is undoubtedly the most beautiful setting from which I have ever podcasted. I am sitting on a seawall on the Long Island Sound, looking out at the water as the sun sets. It is impossibly serene. In the distance, I can see there's a small island with a lighthouse blinking. There are distant ducks honking, and I gotta say, it's not getting me there because I am so mad about sports.
I mean, okay, Jay Gatsby.
Well, I'm on the other side, right? I see far enough, I can see the green light representing Daisy's home on the East Egg or the West Egg, whichever one it was. But no, I'm on the Connecticut side.
The first place Mets did not have the greatest weekend, I suppose, and that extends beyond losing 2 of 3 to the Reds. We're recording this on Monday night. During the game against the Marlins, the Mets trail currently, and Javi Baez has already stumbled around first base at one point in the proceedings, and Tyler McGill gave up a lot of runs early in the game. So not great news on that front. We're going to talk about the trade deadline and whether the Mets did enough with basically the one big move with Chicago for Baez and Trevor Williams, who's now in AAA. And then there's DeGrom's injury, and the Mets did not sign Kumar Rocker. Because basically, in the words of the owner, he was not an asset who would return enough on the investment.
That's what's making me mad. Spoiler alert, I'm not that mad about the trade deadline. I'm mad about something you pointed out about the trade deadline, which was that to become the Dodgers East, which is the Mets' stated goal, they need simply a lot more organizational depth in terms of high-end minor league talent. Now, that's the type of thing that's going to take them years, and it's going to take them money, and it's going to take them some luck and good drafts and great scouting and great analytics and a whole lot. But then, you know, to know that supposedly the steal of the draft falls into their laps, Kumar Rocker, the Vanderbilt pitcher, who has been healthy throughout his college career, I don't know the specifics, the particulars, but it did sound like by all accounts, it seemed like they were going to sign him. They had agreed to a $6 million signing bonus, which is slightly above slot. They did not do what teams sometimes do when they are unsure about signing above slot top pick, which is later draft players that they won't be able to sign for slot value. So in case you can't sign your top guy, then you can go above the slot value for those other guys and at least get some later round talent that might be something more than their draft positions. But I think it's not the specifics of this that bother me so much, because I don't know if Kumar Rocker will ever, maybe the Mets are right. Maybe this is the one time ever that the Mets medical team has adequately and accurately spied something wrong in a pitcher's medicals. And maybe Kumar Rocker, you know, and this is a horrible thing if it's true for him, maybe he's toast, right? For all I know, he's toast. I can't tell you that he isn't. I'm not a doctor. I haven't evaluated him. I haven't spoken to him. I barely know what he looks like. But to see the owner of the team, just the most patronizing and inhuman tweet, Right, just to, you know, and like I know so many people love Steve Cohen so much. He has this avuncular Twitter persona, like he's not a cutthroat $10 billion insider trading hedge fund guy, right? And you know, he can put on this sort of goofy character on Twitter and act like he's normal. That's not a normal guy. No one normal makes $10 billion. And you begin to see the cracks in the persona when he reveals something like this, which is starting with Education Time. This is an extraordinarily patronizing way to get into a tweet, and then just simply referring to this 21-year-old kid who has worked his entire life to play professional baseball, whom now they are, the Mets, are not offering a contract despite drafting, despite the fact that the MLB draft now will not permit this guy to sign elsewhere, right? This is like collusion by any name. And the only reason Major League Baseball can get away with it is because they are legally exempt from constitutional law, right? And Steve Cohen is gonna get all high and mighty and say like, oh no, this is not how you make it. Trust me, I know about investments and this is not the investment I want to make. Like, if I want to say my true feelings about it, we would have to put the explicit tag on the podcast, and we're not going to do that. But it makes me so just like vehemently. I'm just. It makes me so mad. Like it to be so callous as the team owner, right? When you're supposed to be like, how about fostering goodwill with your players, and how about not just how about just being a, not even as a team owner, just as a person, just be a person and realize that this is a 21-year-old who, if he is really hurt, is now facing the possibility that the one thing he has worked his entire life for is not going to work out for him. After people have been telling me he's going to be 1-1, after people saying, you're the best pitcher in college baseball, you're the biggest star that's come through college baseball in a decade, and maybe it's not going to happen for you now. And this guy who is in the position to make it not happen, who is the ultimately the guy who could sign the check, who could say, hey, you know what, you're not $6 million to us with whatever is going on, but maybe we'll work out 4.5. Maybe we'll work out, you know, I don't know. I wasn't in the negotiations. You don't know. But the Mets didn't offer him a contract by all the reports. To have that guy just come out and act like this is just like any other business decision just rubs me so very wrong.
Yeah, like it's a little bit of saying the quiet part out loud about the draft. You know, like a lot of people were wondering in the aftermath of this, like, why doesn't Kumar Rocker get to be a free agent now? Like, he wasn't offered anything by the team that drafted him. Why doesn't he get to, you know, kind of pick and choose and have his own market value? And the answer to that is like, well, if he did that, then every draft pick would not want to be signed to get to the open market. It wasn't that long ago that the Red Sox, when Yoan Moncada hit the open market as, you know, a guy who people said was a top 3 or 5 talent, were he in the MLB draft, but he wasn't because he was a Cuban defector, paid $63 million for him.
Mm-hmm. And like half of, yeah, penalties. Yeah.
$31.5 million to him as a bonus, $31.5 million in penalties. That's how much a player of that, I mean, obviously if everyone were available in that way, then you wouldn't have a one-time $63 million payment. But, you know, that's how much these guys can be worth if there were a true open market for them. That's why the slot bonus system is in place. And, you know, like what this comes down to, it's a difficult thing to gauge because, you know, right now on the night of August 2nd, we want to really be able to assign blame for this between the Mets and Rocker. And, you know, without knowing the medicals and no one is going to report the medicals, like, clearly, because, you know, that's part of Rocker's privacy. It's difficult to say whether the Mets made the right choice here, whether it is proper for them to think that the 11th pick in next year's draft is worth more than Kumar Rocker based off of what they saw in his medical history. I agree with you that the way they've gone about it has not felt very good. You know, it doesn't make you feel good if you're a prospect next year. And the Mets, you know, kind of similar to what they did with Rocker. Like, if we get you to that pick, we'll reward you with an overslot bonus. If they do that with a guy next year, what's to prevent that guy from going, how do I know? You know, yeah. How do I know you're going to honor the promise the way you backed out last year? And, you know, you mentioned the lack of depth in the farm system. That's a lost year of development. Like, it's nice that it's worked out for some other teams that have done this, that, you know, the Astros got Alex Bregman instead of Brady Aiken, or that they got, I guess Pittsburgh got Austin Meadows instead of Mark Appel. But, you know, like if Mark Appel were as good as he should have been, like that was not a medical issue, you know, that was just he didn't want to sign for what the Pirates offered him. If he turned into a very good pitcher, like that would have been awful for the Pirates. Almost as bad as like trading Austin Meadows in a terrible trade for Chris Archer. So this is the way, like you look at the Mets, the last four drafts, they have had 9 picks in the first 2 rounds. They've only got 3 of them still in the system. They only have Brett Beatty, their 2019 first round pick. They have Calvin Ziegler, their 2021 second round pick. And they have one other, JT Ginn from last year, 2020 second round pick. The other 6, you know, Rocker didn't sign, and 5 of them have been traded. They've traded their 2016 first round picks. You want to know why they're not able to make the big moves that other teams were able to make in the last week? It's because they don't have those guys in the system anymore. They've got 5 or 6 guys that other teams like that the Mets don't want to trade because they only have 5 or 6 of them instead of 10 or 12 of them. And they can't, you know, the Giants, I was talking to actually my brother today, and he was like, it seems like the Giants didn't trade as much for Bryant as the Mets did for Baez. And I said, no, actually, they traded more.
Yeah, significantly more. It's just a less of a hit to their system.
Right, because like the guy that's the 9th best prospect in the Giants system is better than the 9th best prospect in the Mets system by a fair margin. And I talked to some teams that talked to the Mets in the past week, and the point they made was, you know, there wasn't that second tier of guy that you can say, you can give us one of these top tier guys. You can give us a Ronnie Mauricio or a Pete Crow Armstrong, or give us 2 of this next tier. That's kind of what the Yankees did for Joey Gallo, right? And it's what the Giants did for Bryant. The Mets don't have that second tier, and it's because of the way they've operated with their farm system. It's because they've traded talent instead of spending cash, basically, for a long time.
Yeah, and I mean, something that came up, you know, the Scherzer deal wasn't, Max Scherzer wasn't going to come to New York. That was clear that the Nats didn't want to deal him, that he didn't want to come. But if you look at the deal, the players that the main players that the Dodgers traded in that package, they're not top 10 overall prospects, but both K-Bear Ruiz and Josiah Gray are big league ready guys, ready to go. The Mets top prospects are all in A ball, you know, so it's a much different. You can't just look at the list and be like, oh, well, Francisco Alvarez, it says he's number 16 in baseball. He's a catcher in A ball. He's 3-4 years away, right? If a team is looking and just like the Minnesota Twins were, just like the Washington Nationals are, is looking to turn things around quickly, they're not going to go for a 19-year-old A ball catcher. It's just not what you're looking for when you can have a far more sure thing if you go calling another organization.
And that's why kind of the last 6 weeks or so when we've talked about the trade deadline, like the team that made the most sense for the Mets as a match was Colorado, because they were the team that needed anything, right? Mm-hmm. They were not, you know, Minnesota and Chicago and Washington were going to look for guys who were nearer to the major leagues, maybe less so the Cubs, but the Rockies were the team that like they were going through the complete overhaul, mm-hmm. and they happened to be the team that kind of angered everyone else in baseball by just not, you know, as I tweeted the other day, like they're not acting in a way that every other team would act.
We're not even picking up the phone. Sorry, I'm busy.
That they were just like, no, we're just gonna try to sign John Gray, and we're gonna give a qualifying offer to Trevor Story, and think that's equal value. And you know, it's nice to have a team in baseball that doesn't operate the same as everyone else, except when you want to make a deal with that team. So,
right. So they have the guys you need. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what hurt the Mets in that regard.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Well, but let's talk about the trade deadline, because I think, you know, there's I've seen it spun a couple of different ways. A big piece of this is that the Mets knew at least a couple hours before the trade deadline that Jacob deGrom would have to be shut down for a few weeks. And shutting Jacob deGrom down for 2 weeks at this point means you're realistically not going to see him again until September. And you have to account for the possibility you won't see him again at all this year. Right, like that is just a plain and you know, very, I don't want to say likely, but it is not unlikely that Jacob deGrom's done for the year. It's unfortunate, but it you know, he's a pitcher with an arm injury that is lingering, and it's already August, so it's a real possibility. And so a lot of people read that to mean, well, why didn't the Mets, again, and we can say why they couldn't get Berrios and why they couldn't get Scherzer. They didn't have the horses to make those deals. But, you know, why didn't they go out and try to make a deal? I mean, you could argue they didn't have the horses to get Kyle Gibson and Ian Kennedy either. But why couldn't they have found themselves a pitcher better than Trevor Williams? And the first name off the top of my head that didn't get traded that was rumored was like Caleb Smith of the Diamondbacks, like would be an upgrade to the back end of their rotation. But he's not going to be Jacob deGrom. And that's what Scott said. And for me, it's like I can't kill them for not going big on a pitcher, because it's something we talked about just before the deadline, which is if you know there's a real good chance DeGrom's not going to be part of your rotation in August and a chance he's not going to be in September and a chance he's not going to be in the postseason, well, then your postseason odds look a whole lot longer. Not necessarily getting there, but certainly succeeding there. And Caleb Smith, to me, that just doesn't change that equation. The guy who does is Scherzer and Berrios, but those guys were not really on the table for them. So I don't know that there certainly was no move made at the trade deadline where I could say, okay, the Mets could have matched this and the Mets should have matched this.
Yeah, I think, you know, Scherzer was not going to come to New York. Berrios, the Mets, you know, when they found out the news about DeGrom on Friday, that was the team they went back to. The talks with the Twins had kind of died down earlier in the week. You know, the Mets were not going to pay the price the Twins wanted for Berrios. And they called back and were like, hey, like, we're a little bit more interested now. Like, what do you got? It sounded like essentially the Twins were like, this is the deal we have, the one that they eventually did with Toronto. And the Mets were like, what about this? And the Twins said, no, that's not close.
I mean, they got a number 5 overall pick, right, who is playing well, a shortstop playing well in Double-A. Like, that guy's going to be in the majors next year.
Yeah, so, you know, the Mets would have had to come back with probably something like Ronnie Mauricio and Matt Allen. And even that, like, because of the timeline, both of those guys are farther away from the major leagues than Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson. That probably wouldn't have worked as well for Minnesota as the Toronto deal did. So I don't think they really, again, like, they had the horses for Berrios. The guy that I was interested in why nothing happened with, and not just with the Mets, but overall, is Michael Pineda with the Twins.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a rental. The Twins clearly sold on some other guys. It seemed like that could have been another arm they moved, and someone who, you know, would have helped the Mets in a different way than Trevor Williams. You know, there's some things to like about Trevor Williams. Maybe if he just throws his slider a lot more, he can be a useful arm, maybe in shorter stints, maybe even out of the bullpen. But certainly, you know, if you're looking at this rotation, like, you're living with a 5-man rotation right now that is Stroman, Walker, McGill, Carrasco, and Rich Hill. And, you know, outside of Stroman and Walker, and even Walker obviously has not pitched well since the All-Star break, those aren't guys you're counting on to go 6 innings with consistency. You know, Hill is probably a 2 turns through the order and out kind of guy at this point, and that's how the Dodgers treated him for a long time. McGill has started to throw 6 innings. He's having a rough start on Monday night, his first real rough one. But, you know, is probably not a guy you're thinking is going to give you 6 every time out there. And same with Carrasco at this point. He's got to work his way up to that. And, you know, the Mets wanted to go to, or at least talking about going to a 6-man rotation once DeGrom came back in August before the setback, where they could give those guys more rest. And now they don't have that. Or if they want to go 6-man, then they have to use Williams, who's another guy who's probably not going to throw 6 innings for you. So that just stresses the bullpen out even more. You know, it would have been nice. It's hard at the trade deadline when you've got a situation like the DeGrom situation to operate in ways that are that help you kind of in different possibilities, different hypotheticals. You want to build your team so that if DeGrom is back in August or something, or if DeGrom comes back on September 1st and looks like DeGrom into the postseason, you have given yourself the best chance to do something in the postseason. But because there's also the chance that he doesn't come back right away on September 1st, or he doesn't come back at full strength, you don't go too hard on in buying for the 2021 postseason. You might not have your most important piece, but also you want to have the team that if he's healthy, maybe just on October 1st and is back for the postseason, you want to make sure you get there for it. You want to make sure that's useful. So there's kind of, you're juggling these different scenarios in the air, and you end up taking this kind of in-between approach. It was not an all-out buy because they didn't get a starting pitcher alongside Javi Baez, but it wasn't a sit-pat and do nothing. You know, you got the 2018 MVP runner-up, and you gave up one of your best prospects to get him for 2 months. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And really, I think, you know, the ceiling of this team is directly tied to what Jacob DeGrom's health status is come September.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, like, you know, I had said it on the podcast before the trade deadline, like, Baez was the guy I wanted. I think the cost seems reasonable. Like, when I heard, I saw it reported, I think Bob Nightingale, my old teammate, reported, said, like, Pete Crow Armstrong is going in the deal. I was like, oh, that's funny. It's funny that, you know, only one small part of the deal is leaking out before the rest of the package. And that's not to knock Pete Crow Armstrong, but he's a 19-year-old who's missing the entire season with shoulder surgery. Like, to me, that's a move you have to make. And I just, I feel like, you know, I hope for his sake he has a nice career, but I don't know that, to me, it seems like a no-brainer to deal a guy that far away. And with the uncertainty, certainly, that comes with a shoulder injury, for a guy like Javier Baez, who we saw it in his first game with the big home run, and just brings an energy, you know, like the way I see it. If this team is going to succeed now, especially with DeGrom out, it's not going to be starting pitching. Like, you know, it was the pitching in the first half. The pitching kept them above water. Their offense has been bad. There's no sugarcoating that the offense seemed like it would be good and has instead been bad. Injuries have played an absolutely tremendous part of it. I think if this team's going to succeed from this point forward, it needs to be the offense firing on all cylinders, and I think it can do that. And to me, adding a guy like Baez, who does give you, you know, a different look, who does, you know, jumps on first pitches, swings at everything, you know, it's a largely a patient, disciplined Sandy Alderson type offense, and to have that one guy who is, you know, hyper aggressive in there, in addition to, you know, everything else he brings to the table defensively and as a base runner and seemingly as a teammate. I love that move. I just think it's extremely fun. It's a lovely story that he and Lindor are so close. I would be thrilled if they could re-sign him. I just think he's a electric player, like I said in the last one. So I'm good with the trade deadline. I'm not good with the Kumar Rocker thing.
Yeah, and we'll see. You know, like, that offense has to, you need Michael Conforto to be hitting better than the 109 or whatever he hit on the last homestand over 11 games, when it seemed like he was turning a corner based off the road trip before that. So
he looks lost.
Yeah, I mean, he does. He looks kind of the way Lindor did earlier in the season. You know, you can, it's just been a very strange season for them offensively that really none of those guys have gotten into, have had the kind of expected season, or have had the season you expect them to have. They're all kind of below what you would have projected going into the year. And Alonso has been hot lately. McNeil's been hot. You know, Nimmo's had a nice year, but he's now dealing with a physical issue. So it's, they just haven't clicked for any length of time offensively, and they're going to need to in order to, I mean, I don't know. The NL East is so bad at this point that, like, I don't know that, like maybe they win it with 85 wins. Maybe that's enough. Maybe they go 500 the rest of the stretch, and that's good enough to win this division. But
the Braves tooled up a little bit, right? Like, the Braves at least added some roster depth. Like, they didn't make a big move, but to me, the Braves at least indicated, like, hey, we want to make a play for this, and the Phillies did too, right? Adding two big pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, the Braves made their Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe move, essentially, right. in getting Adam Duvall and Jorge Soler and Eddie Rosario for when he comes back. That, like, I like that all three of them are essentially the same type of player. They're all, like, guys who are going to hit home runs, not get on base at a 300 clip. Two of them are righties, one's a lefty.
Jorge Soler, Jorge Soler feels somehow to me like he's always been on the Braves.
So, like, you know, they're improving it, like, the upgrade from the Abraham Almonte, Orlando Arcia platoon that they were running out there, which, you know, Almonte had a nice series against the Mets last week, but aside from that, had not done a lot. Like, that's an upgrade for them. And we'll see, you know, I think Richard Rodriguez in the bullpen is a big get for them because of the way the back end, especially from the right side for them, has pitched this year.
And
the
Phillies, really cool hair.
And the Phillies with Gibson, I thought it was a strange trade because Spencer Howard was so well regarded not that long ago, and they didn't really give him a real fair chance.
Right.
They kind of bounced him back and forth between the rotation and the bullpen. But they also got a prospect back in the deal. They're moving Ranger Suarez from the closing role to the rotation, so Kennedy doesn't, like, he helps out the bullpen, but he's just replacing the one guy there who was good, and maybe Suarez can be a good starter. He pitched well on Monday in three innings, but you know, none of those teams made the move that, like, I think we talked a little bit about it a few times ago, like the 2015 Blue Jays were a team that were 500 or under 500 at the trade deadline,
and then they went wild.
Had a great run differential. You know, that team was run by Alex Anthopoulos, who's now the GM of the Braves. Like, he could have viewed that, you know, the Braves had the best run differential in the division. He could have viewed that this Braves team the same way. Acuna's injury is probably the reason he didn't. But, you know, that Blue Jays team, when they traded for Price and Tulowitzki, I think Ben Revere, they made some other moves. Like, when they did that, it was like, oh, like, that's a team that's going to throw a scare into the Yankees, who were in first at the time, even though they were six or seven back. I don't think the moves the Braves or Phillies made are that kind of threat to the Mets. I would still pick the Mets to win the division, but if a few weeks ago I thought that the Mets would win it with, you know, would have it clinched by that final series in Atlanta, now I think that series might be meaningful.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that they still need to be the favorite to win the division, if only because they're starting out a couple games ahead. Like, even if they're all 500 teams at this point, the Mets are the ones starting from the catbird seat. I don't know. It's been a wild few days. I would say that at the very least, and even after he pulled up limping a little bit today, he has remained in the game. I'm psyched about Javi Baez. I'm good with that. I am looking forward to seeing how that plays out. And I have a question for you. I was trying to remember what you had said that jogged my question. Michael Conforto, is he getting a qualifying offer at this point? And does he take it?
I think you still give him a qualifying offer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Mets, where they are financially now, should be the team that gives qualifying offers on any of these questionable ones.
What about Syndergaard?
I think you give him a qualifying offer.
I agree.
Like, both of those guys, I think if they hit the open market, will probably do reasonably well. I think they're both guys who are going to sign deals for $50 million or more if they hit the open market.
But you think Conforto after this year?
Yeah. I mean, I don't – Conforto, like, I think he's got a good chance of accepting the qualifying offer at this point. But that's because he would want to rebuild value to sign the $100 million contract rather than the $70 million contract. Like, he's on pace to get something that's more akin to, like, Marcelo Zuna's deal than George Springer's deal. I don't think one bad season, and it's been a bad season for him, but one bad season under unusual physical circumstances, I don't think you can totally discount the fact that he had COVID in February. I'm not sure exactly what role that plays in the year that he's had, but he couldn't have, like, a full normal offseason. If I were the Mets, I would still want him as part of the team long term. If I were another team, I would say, like, this could be a good bargain in free agency because of how bad the year has gone. You know, like, look at Marcus Semien, a guy who a lot of people wrote off because his 2020 was not as good as his 2019.
Bargain of the offseason by far.
If you looked closely, there were good indicators. There were more good indicators for Semien than there are for Conforto at the moment. But I think both of them definitely get qualifying offers in my mind. And I think both of them, it would not surprise me if both of them took the qualifying offer just to rebuild their value. You know, Syndergaard, we have to see how many starts he actually makes. If he makes four really good starts, then I think he might turn it down. And you know, Rich Hill only needed four really good starts back in 2015 to get a deal. So we'll see on him. With Conforto, I think, if he turns it around, even if he has a bad regular season and then hits well in the postseason, that's often enough to just show, like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of back to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think both of those guys you do still extend the qualifying offer for. And I think that's what the Mets think also at this point.
Second question, and then we'll get to our actual reader question, then we'll wrap up. But so now the Mets, if without signing Rocker, that means they're going to get the number 11 pick in next year's draft plus whatever pick they earn with their finish this year. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is a confusing aspect of the current CBA, and the current CBA expires, so we don't know. We don't know where it will come down come June, but if the Mets, so it's hard to think of what player it will be that will get a qualifying offer that they might pursue in free agency, because now Baez can't get a qualifying offer, now Chris Bryant can't get a qualifying offer. Guys who have been traded are no longer eligible, and that means they won't require draft pick compensation. But correct me if I'm wrong, if they go out and try to sign a free agent, and they sign a free agent who did reject a qualifying offer, that means they're going to have to give up what is their, if I've read it correctly, their second pick, which will now be a first round pick.
You're going to make me look this up now.
Because they're in the middle tier of like the teams that aren't exceeding the luxury tax or getting revenue sharing. So and I believe that the rule is you give up your second draft pick if you sign a player who received a qualifying offer. Now that I believe that could change by the spring, unless they grandfather it in for this year or whatever, or make it permanent. Well, I guess my Mets fan nightmare scenario, and maybe this isn't fair to this current front office, is that now not only do they not sign Kumar Rocker, but now they're going to say in the offseason, like, oh, no, sorry, we can't make a run at Corey Seager or Trevor Story or John Gray or whoever, whatever other guy it is that turned down a qualifying offer, because we don't want to have to give up a first-round draft pick for him.
Yeah, I reading it, I believe your interpretation is correct. It would be their second highest pick, which would be the first-round pick they earn somewhere, if you're projecting out right now, somewhere around like the 18th pick or so, which would be, a heavy price to pay. The other scenario you can think about, kind of the opposite end of it, is if you give qualifying offers to Conforto and Syndergaard and they reject them and go elsewhere, you get the two picks there, after the second round, you could end up with the Mets having five picks in like the first 80 picks mm-hmm. of the draft. That's not exactly comfort for your major league roster at this point, because you would then need to replace Conforto and Syndergaard, and you'd have to replace Stroman, and you'd have a lot of holes on your major league roster, and you wouldn't want to give up your one of those draft picks. But that's part of the calculation here with the qualifying offer as well with those guys. It would be, I'm trying to think of who they would want to sign in that scenario. Whether it's an outfielder to replace Conforto, they would probably be in the market for a starting pitcher. I don't know that they'd want to sign the top end starting pitcher. I mean, Scherzer, for instance, cannot get a qualifying offer now.
Right.
So that would be an interesting name on the market, though I would assume his stance against New York would maintain into the offseason. That's projecting out into October and November decisions, and the Mets have enough on their plate right now.
That is absolutely fair. Speaking of which, and this is a tricky question. This comes from Clay Davis on Twitter. Not the real fictional Clay Davis, but some guy purporting to be the Senator Clay Davis from The Wire. He wants to know, he says, I think it would be fair for you and Tim Britton to address the training and performance staff at this point. Where is the accountability? They've gone through, almost 60 players this season? Something is not right with that. Not all injuries are freak accidents like with Kevin Pillar.
Yeah, Baseball Prospectus has done a great job this year with kind of tracking the injured, like how different teams compare on in terms of the injured list this year. I believe the Mets on the they're currently second in terms of most players on the injured list behind Tampa Bay. They're like they're in the top five in terms of days missed on the course of the season. Let me see. They are number one in terms of wins above replacement missed over the course of the season in baseball this year. You know, obviously injuries have been a key storyline for the Mets all year, most notably at like the end of May, but continuing on. You know, injuries have been bad everywhere. I think you have to kind of put it in
right.
An IL plus stat. Like
I couldn't provide
the context for it.
I clicked around. I couldn't find another team that had used, I think, 58 players entering play on Monday, which the Mets were at. But and I didn't click every team. But there are a bunch of teams who have used in the 50s of players. Like, it's not uncommon that the number of injuries is just, I think, just up this year because of how weird the last 2 years have been.
Yeah, you know, everyone knew the number of injuries were going to be up this year. The other good thing that Baseball Prospectus has done, they had a story that actually ran today on Monday by Derek Rhodes and Rob Maines about hamstring injuries and like which teams have had the most hamstring injuries in the last several years, last 4 years in particular. And the Mets, I believe, ranked third in the league. Like it's the White Sox who've had 16 hamstring related injuries. The Rays have had 15. The Mets have had 14. The Mariners have had one. So
they're really doing a lot of yoga in Seattle.
So clearly, like, it does seem, you know, when people talk about injury prevention, it's really about soft tissue injuries. Like, as the senator pointed out, like, you know, you can't really prevent the pilar injury. What you're hoping right. to prevent are the hamstring strains, the oblique strains, those types of things that lead to long-term absences that are soft tissue. You know, the Mets... You don't have Ray Ramirez to kick around anymore because he was viewed as that guy for so long in the organization. Mm-hmm. They moved on from him.
I mean, you know, I've heard so many different places blamed for the Mets injuries. Like Jeff Wilpon. Everybody said it was, oh, this is because Jeff Wilpon forces them to play through injuries. Now Jeff Wilpon's not forcing people to play through injuries anymore, I assume, right? So,
that's why so many guys are on the IL now. They're not being forced to play through them.
Oh, right, because Jeff Wilpon's not like, come on, rub some dirt on it.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm scrolling down farther on this article, and the Mets have had the second most upper leg injuries as well, if you add in the quadriceps. So, you know, I think it's the Mets, just like the Yankees did in the last couple of years, and kind of were introspective and contemplative and self-reflective about what are we doing wrong? Because clearly, like, you know, there might not be that many teams that are doing it right in terms of injuries, but clearly we're not doing it as well as the majority of the league for some reason. With our training, we should probably do something differently. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if it's, you know, if it can be done by people currently.
Bend over and touch everybody before we go out and play baseball. We just spend like 10 seconds touching our toes.
I remember once talking to someone who had been on the Mets in the mid-2000s, who was just like, he went to some other team and he was like, I just couldn't believe how different the stretching routine was. And I was like, oh, this is why Jose Reyes always tears his hamstring. Like, they're just the Mets were stretching wrong at that time. I don't think they have changed since then. I do think they have changed since then. But, you know, they've had a different staff in place since, I believe, 2018 was when these guys came in. It's been 4 years. It hasn't been that much better than before. I don't know what the answer is.
It's so crazy that we're like, because you know, like we know rationally, like to be the trainer for the Mets, you need to be like the best in the world at that job, right? Like these people must be so extraordinarily well trained and well educated in this field that, like, obviously, like I'm being glib when I say touch your toes, like they know about touching your toes, you know? Like, and so it's such a hard thing to wrap your head around that. And you see with the Yankees too, like it's something I always think about with Giancarlo Stanton is like, why doesn't this guy stretch more? You know, they must be doing the right thing. I don't know. I feel so weird speculating about it because, like, there's just no way I'm more qualified to tell you why the Mets get injured all the time than the guys who are in the trainer's room, you know, wrapping up members of the Mets. And yet, here we are looking at those that data that you're showing me that says the Mets get injured more than the other teams. So there is someone out there who knows more, or maybe it's luck. But maybe there is someone out there who knows more than the Mets guys about preventing hamstring injuries.
Yeah, you know, I like the end of the BP story says maybe James Clifford, Seattle's director of strength and conditioning. You know, the Mariners have only had the one hamstring strain in 4 years. Will be as hotly pursued as Carlos Correa or Freddie Freeman this winter. And, you know, that does...
Two guys will get qualifying offers. Those are good examples.
Yeah. You know, I think we've talked around it in baseball the last couple of years of how, like, what the next frontier is. And it is probably this area, like looking at biometrics on guys and trying to predict health and prevent injury on a more advanced level than teams have been able to, and certainly the Mets have been able to lately. So it will be interesting to see, you know, the Mets have made some infrastructure investments under the new ownership, if that is another area they look to, if not overhaul, at least add on to over the next year or so.
Did you see Edwin Diaz's Instagram with, like, he has, like, weird leg brace ice bucket things?
I did see that at one point.
Get everybody that thing.
There's just... There are so many different things that guys use. And, you know, it's, you know, Noah Syndergaard had his GQ story where he's talking about all of the different things that he does for his body. And it happens to run like 3 days before he suffers a physical setback. Like, the game is hard. Guys are trying different things and not all of them work out. That doesn't mean that hyperbaric chambers are bad. They seem to work well for Marcus Stroman. Like, you know, they work well for guys in other sports. Like, it's hard because it's your physical health. It's an idiosyncratic thing. Guys get blamed for it. Like, it's not Bill Walton's fault that his foot always fell apart on him, or it's not Jed Lowry's fault that he gets hurt a little bit more easily than Cal Ripken Jr. did. That, you know, it's not necessarily a character flaw to get hurt, but it is something you have to factor in when you talk about a player's value and his availability for you and what your team is doing to keep those guys available.
None of this would be happening if they all wore fighting necklaces.
I remember seeing some intelligent people who had gone to school for science wearing fighting necklaces in the clubhouse and being very, very bewildered by that.
They looked cool. I mean, I think if you ask them, they'd be like, yeah, it just looks cool. I think, it's like a team color necklace. I get to accessorize. But then there were definitely people who were like, no, bro, it's magnets.
This is the way I'm going to stay healthy.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I hope you stay healthy until later in the week when we next speak. And ideally, so will the Mets.
Yeah, we'll knock on wood for that. Adios.
Peace out.